KALW.
Public charge rule gives immigration officials a lot of leeway in these decisions.
The Trump administration is implementing a new rule that could deny green cards to low-income immigrants.
That's one of the dangers of discretion. We don't know what this will look like when it rolls out. We don't know what this will look like when people are deciding.
We'll hear how California is responding to the public charge rule. Then Sarah Moore doesn't clown around when it comes to their line of work.
Yeah, because it does come from your deepest, the deepest part of yourself. You know, the clown is really like your, the core of who you are. It's that little tiny person that's inside. You going?
And we're answering a question from a listener like you just in time for Valentine's Day.
What's the best spot in the Bay Area to have a first kiss?
I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Last month, the Supreme Court ruled that the Trump administration can start rolling out a controversial policy known as the public charge rule. This policy could systematically deny green cards to low-income immigrants. It's going into effect on February 24th, and it's made some immigrant families reluctant to use public benefits like food stamps or Medicaid. KLW immigration reporter Teresa Katsarilis is here with me to break down who this new rule could impact. High Teresa.
Hey, Hannah.
So we have talked about this before, but just for the sake of review, what is the public charge rule?
Right. So just to recap, when a person applies for a green card, immigration officials conduct this thing called a public charge test. They're trying to figure out whether the person in question will become completely dependent on the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. If you're considered a public charge, that weighs against your eligibility for a green card. This rule didn't used to be that big a deal. The government used to apply it pretty narrowly.
Right. But the Trump administration has just changed that.
Exactly. An expanded version of public charge is going into effect, at least temporarily, on February 24th. Reporters from the New York Times, the Washington Post, and PBS are all calling this a wealth test for immigrants.
What do they mean by that? What is different about this?
So, under this new rule, immigrants can be denied green cards if they've ever used really common public benefits like Medicaid, food stamps, housing vouchers, think Section 8 here, or cash assistance like welfare.
Those are all pretty commonly used.
They're very commonly used. Mm-hmm. They're among the most commonly used services in the United States,
right,
in terms of public benefits, at least. There are other programs included in the expanded public charge rule, but those are kind of the big four.
Mm.
And immigrants can be denied a green card even if they only used those programs once.
Okay, so let's explain this. Say I'm an immigrant applying for my green card. I do qualify for benefits, and I could use them, but I decide not to. Am I in the clear here?
Maybe, maybe not. You could still be considered a public charge if your income is really far below the poverty line. And even if it's not, you still might run into problems.
Hmm.
Under this new rule, you could also be denied a green card if immigration officials look at your application and think you are, quote, more likely than not to use any of those public benefits in the future.
Wait a minute. Teresa, what do you mean more likely than not? How do officials tell if I'm going to need or use these public benefits at some point in the future? How do they determine that?
So I also found this confusing, quite frankly. So last week, I asked attorney Erin Lee about it. She works for the East Bay Community Law Center, a nonprofit that offers free legal advice in the East Bay. They've been following the public charge rule really closely.
Would it be possible under this new rule for an immigration official, like it appears to be vaguely written enough, someone just look at someone and be like, well, you look like you could be poor, so I'm not going to give you a green card? Like, is that on the table?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the dangers of discretion. We don't know what this will look like when it rolls out. We don't know what this will look like when people are deciding.
So that could happen, but it would be up to the discretion of the individual immigration officials.
Exactly. The public charge rule gives immigration officials a lot of leeway in these decisions, and we really just don't know what the implementation of this rule could look like.
So this policy has understandably generated a lot of fear in immigrant communities.
Exactly.
How's that fear impacting these communities?
Well, Erin Lee says the East Bay Community Law Center is already really seeing an impact. She says that some of her organization's clients are just going without benefits.
We work with many families with new babies who are afraid to get benefits to help their U.S. citizen babies. We also work with a lot of people who have different types of disabilities, mental health, HIV.
So this trend that Lee is seeing was actually predicted by studies out of UC Berkeley, UCLA, and other institutions. There's just so much fear surrounding this policy that some people are playing it safe and not using public assistance at all.
Mm-hmm. But Teresa, the public charge rule only applies to certain public benefits and certain people, right? So
exactly.
Who's actually going to be affected by this?
Yeah, let's clear up some of the confusion here. I really want to stress that public charge only applies to certain kinds of immigrants, and most immigrants actually will not be affected by this change.
Okay.
So just to review, if you already have a green card, this is not an issue. If you are on a humanitarian visa, you're a refugee or have been granted asylum, for instance, mm-hmm. you're good. This does not apply to you either. Also, you have to legally be in the country and preparing to apply for your green card. So if you're undocumented, for instance, this does not apply to you either.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And then last but not least, just to be totally clear, if you're an immigrant but you're applying for benefits on behalf of your child who's an American citizen, you are also in the clear. Public charge does not apply.
Okay. Do you think this information is well known, or are people still not going to be getting, you know, the medical care they need, the food stamps they need, just out of fear?
I mean, honestly, I think that a lot of Californian government agencies and nonprofits are really afraid of that.
Mm-hmm.
And they are currently mobilizing to try to release public statements about this and really let people know what their rights are. You know, just as an example, Bay Area school districts have already reassured parents that the rule does not apply to school lunches. That mm-hmm. is one of the public benefits that is exempt from
yeah.
this rule. State agencies are encouraging folks to consult with an immigration attorney this month to see if public charge applies to them. That can obviously get expensive, so agencies are directing residents to free legal immigration services.
Mm-hmm.
We will be linking to a list of those nonprofits at KLW's website, if anyone is curious.
Okay, just to recap, this only applies to legal low-income immigrants who are eligible to apply for green cards.
Exactly.
Okay.
Or are going to be eligible in the next few years.
Mm-hmm.
And it also does not apply to every public benefit program, so you should check with an attorney if you think this could apply to you.
Could you give me an example of a social program that public charge does not apply to?
Sure. Food banks, homeless shelters, school lunch programs, which we just mentioned. Also WIC benefits, that's assistance for young mothers and their babies. And it does not apply to WIC.
All right. Thank you, Teresa.
Thanks, Hannah.
Teresa Katsarilis is KELW's immigration reporter. You can reach her at immigration@kelw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Sarah Moore's craft of clowning has taken her around the country. They've performed in Merv Griffin Atlantic City hotels, traveled with Ringling Brothers, and is now the director of the Clown Conservatory in San Francisco. Sarah's latest show is called The Supers, a science fiction, magical realism, human cartoon opera. For three decades, she's given people the gift of laughter, but clowning has also been self-empowering for Sarah when it comes to gender. KLW's Janae Darden spoke with Sarah about her work.
So how does a New Jersey kid end up being a clown?
Well, I mean, New Jersey is a really weird gothic place. And if you look at the map of New Jersey, like the whole, you know, the Garden State Parkway and the Turnpike, there's so many people that are from this state and they're all different and weird. So, yeah, I mean, I grew up around Camden, New Jersey, which is a little hub right outside Philadelphia. I was always surrounded by a lot of interesting people. And as a child, my father, who was a school principal, elementary school principal, when I started writing poetry when I was little, he was like, we got to do something with this. So he took me to the Walt Whitman Poetry Center in Camden, New Jersey. And I started very, very hugely reading my poetry to this amazing, very diverse group of usually older people. And it kind of grew from there. The poetry and clowning sort of go hand in hand, weirdly, because they're both, you know, they're both kind of very imaginative forms. They're very, mm-hmm. they're very jazz-like forms, you know. So poetry to me became very performative. And I went from there and then started writing plays. And then I got into musical theater. And then from there, I realized as I got older, I wasn't going to make a living. Usually you don't make a living as an actor. And I knew that I was a kind of a funny woman, a different kind of woman, that I probably wasn't going to get roles that I wanted to play, which were usually all the male roles anyway. So I became a clown. And it's opened up my world. You know, I'm able to play all kinds of different characters through the lens of the clown. I had never really been to a circus as a child. We didn't go to the circus, but I did go to Six Flags and I saw the clowns there and I loved them.
You're the second clown I interviewed that said they didn't see clowns growing up. They
ended up being a clown. Maybe it means you are one. Like you don't see one, you just are one.
Or maybe that's a good thing too, because you can create your own clownness, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because it does come from your deepest part of yourself. You know, the clown is really like the core of who you are. It's that little tiny person that's inside you going with pulling levers and being mischievous. And it gets drummed out of us by the time we're, you know, 10 or 11. And then all of a sudden, you know, we're adolescent and then we're an adult. And all that fun is relegated to a weekend or something, where when you own your clownhood, it's with you all the time. You know, unless you get grumpy and take yourself too seriously, in which case you should go make some art with it. You should make an act out of your grumpiness. I came of age in the 1980s, and it's like at that time, I knew that I was different. I knew I was queer, and I just didn't know how, I didn't know what to do with it. And I was terrified, you know, that like, okay, now I'm going to be up against it, you know, which so many people are. There's so many people of color who are up against it all the time. And there's lots of people with all kinds of different, they're seen differently in the world. You know, there's little people and there's all kinds of people. I mean, now that I've been in the circus, I've been around such a variety of humanity. And so everyone gets judged, you know, for something. But as a young person in the 80s, I was like, okay, I'm queer. What do I do with this? And getting into clowning, it was great because I suddenly had no gender. I decided on a hobo clown, like a tramp clown, like Emmett Kelly. Mm-hmm. And so that immediately put me in this realm of like, no one knew. No one could decide whether I was male or female. So I was right in the middle, which I realized was my natural state. Because there's something inherently funny about masculinity parading as femininity, as hyper-femininity. Mm-hmm. That's funny. Because what man would ever elect to do that, right? Mm-hmm. Well, boy, he's really funny because he's going out there and doing that. Where a woman trying to be, or a female or feminine element trying to be more masculine or male is, it's like, what are you doing on our turf? There's a little bit of that I've experienced. Not that it's out here in the world in San Francisco. I think we have a magnificent drag community here, and everybody's all over the place.
Right.
But out in the bigger world, you know, and in the world of clowning, I think the tux and the hobo worked for me. But there was a little cock of the head, like, why don't you be a big lady clown like the other clowns? Why don't you wear big oversized pumps and a huge wig and, you know, make sure your boobs are out there and everything? And it's like, nah, that wasn't me.
You talked about as far as clowning and humor as medicine.
Well, this is the thing. You know, one of the things I really want the Supers, this big clown opera we're doing, what I want it to do more than anything is show people that clowning is about people helping, like Mr. Rogers said. You know, it's about the people who help. You know, clowning is as much about healing as it is about performance. It's both of those things. And so my goal as an artist is to try to bring those things together. I want to create clown art that puts you into this dreamscape, into this trance-like place where you can then be inspired to go forward and pay that forward.
And let me go to the title of your show. It is The Supers.
The Supers!
A science fiction magical realism human cartoon. Wait a minute, ladies and gentlemen. Opera.
Well, or clown opera for short. I mean, it's nuts. I know it's nuts and it's a lot, but I mean, it is all of those things. I mean, it's really, okay, dare I say this? Maybe this sounds snobby. I don't know. I don't care. But what we're doing here is creating a whole new theatrical genre.
Okay.
And whenever someone says that, it's because they've taken the different techniques and forms of other types of theater and combined them. I mean, this is pantomime. It's total. There isn't one word that's really uttered. There's gibberish. There's vocalizing, but it's all pantomime, and it's all set to this very, very specific musical score. So the music and the movement are like one. All the drama and the comedy of grand opera, but instead of voices, beautiful voices, you're seeing beautiful precision physicality.
And what's the plot?
Okay, it's about a bunch of cosmic immigrants who are in dire straits, and they get off their different planets, and they end up here, of all places.
During this time?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
So they arrive, and they find each other, and they're up against every authoritarian force. But they discover, through their building superintendent, which is a word that we use, you know, on the East Coast, you know, when you live in New York, as I have, you have a super. You know, call the super. He'll fix the door. So they sort of discover through him who they really are. I mean, I think that this could play in any American city. It could be here, Chicago, Philly, New York, I mean, anywhere. And people could say, oh, I recognize that. I know that building and I know that guy. So they're up against this authoritarian, you know, jerk who takes many guises in the play. You know, he's an army. He's outer space itself. He's a customs official. And then he becomes the building superintendent. So the show is about, you know, finding your inner hero, you know, your inner super. And that has many meanings: supernatural, superintendent, you know, superhero. If you're supernatural, then maybe you've got some religion. You've got some spirituality that you can offer. And if you're a superhero, then you're an active person who's going out and really helping people and making a difference. So I'm playing with all those notions through the lens of the clown. You know, if you are different in some way, which we all are. I think everybody is, you know? I mean, there's certain people, of course, who have more privilege than others. Yeah. But it's like everybody is different and everybody has to find a way to make their way in the world and not get into too much trouble, not get judged or abused or whatever. And so clowning to me has been a wonderful, you know, sort of whole entire trance-like world to be in where I can both hide and be seen at the same time.
That was Sarah Moore speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. You can see Sarah in The Supers, a science fiction, magical realism, human cartoon opera. It's running February 19th through the 29th at Z Space in San Francisco. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Next up, we've got Hey Area, where you ask the questions and we go out and find the answers. Listener Cameron Williams wanted to know,
what's the best spot in the Bay Area to have a first kiss?
With Valentine's Day just around the corner, KALW's Julia Linus Goodman investigates.
So Cameron sent us this question because,
at the time, I was getting more serious with my girlfriend. I was thinking, what's like romantic spots in the city?
There are a lot of them. Personally, I've always thought Dolores Park is really romantic. It has rolling green hills, lots of hidden spaces to get some privacy, and a great view of San Francisco. And people seem to agree with me. The park is often full of couples cuddling and making out. So I asked some about their favorite places to kiss.
At the Fillmore.
Golden Gate Park.
Our first kiss was in my apartment after we went to the bar because he was too shy to kiss me.
I was so nervous.
Let's say Twin Peaks.
Here. Dolores Park.
Dolores Park here.
All good answers. But what I really wanted to know is, what are the qualities that make a great spot for a first kiss?
A lot of it has to do with feeling safe, both emotionally and physically.
That's Bernali Ghosh. She's a landscape architect and walking tour guide in Berkeley.
And I think safety is often created by the kind of lighting you have, the kind of landscape you have.
I meet Bernali on Shattuck Avenue, where she and her husband walk home together from BART. They love to kiss here. Why? Well, first there's the right level of light.
Not so much that you feel self-conscious.
Also the right view, it's got a little nature. And she says you want the right amount of activity. Not too much traffic.
Our romantic encounter is sort of interrupted every time we have to cross the street.
And not too much noise.
I think, yeah, like construction noise or leaf blowers would make it hard.
It's not just about the landscape. The people around you matter too. Bernali remembers one time at a dinner party when she and her husband were kissing, and another person there commented,
"You know, I've never seen, like, Indian people kiss publicly."
That didn't feel good. A lot of people take for granted that they can kiss in public, but that's not true for many people. That can be because of race or ethnicity, or because of gender or sexuality.
A lot of queer and trans issues are becoming more visible, which is really beautiful, but that doesn't necessarily equate to safety.
Dominique Cowling works for Community United Against Violence. She helps LGBTQ people build healthy relationships. That can be tricky when it's not always safe or comfortable to be visibly queer.
Maybe we can't hold hands, or maybe we can't kiss in this area or this neighborhood.
Because LGBTQ people still face discrimination.
And so we have to be very, very mindful and vigilant of the certain cities that we're in. Even if they're open and even if they have neighborhoods like the Castro, we still have to be very, very aware, which has an impact on our nervous systems in different ways.
Which can make it hard to get in the mood to kiss someone. But Dominique says there are still places where those things don't get in the way. Like high up in the Berkeley Hills.
Grizzly Peak, if you've ever been, so you can get a nice little view of the bay. Being in nature is a really beautiful thing. I think Mother Nature is kind of queer too and like supports us.
Ultimately, it's about creating a space where both you and your partner can feel comfortable and respected. That's what's really romantic. For Hey Area, I'm Julia Linus Goodman.
Julia is a fellow in KALW's Audio Academy. You can hear more Hey Area answers to listener questions at KALW.org. And while you're on the website, make sure you're also subscribed to the Cross Currents newsletter.
Cupid, draw back your bow and let your arrow go straight to my lover's heart for me.
Tune in Monday at 5. We'll hear how bees in California do a lot more than make honey.
Our whole agricultural system has become dependent on this single vulnerable species of insect. And now it's hard to imagine feeding the country without them.
On Being, a special presentation from 99% Invisible, Monday at 5 on Cross Currents. And before we leave you, here's some local music. This is Kelly Stoltz from San Francisco. They're performing at the Great American Music Hall this Sunday.
A lover's prize, a small beam of light, like the voice inside. My hand disappears in your hand.
Today's Cross Currents team includes True Nguyen, Marissa Ortega-Welch, and Victor Tense. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Dawood Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.